When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, hey, where you been? Buckeye Talk is about to begin. Hey, 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 come on in.
Welcome back to Buckeye Talk. It is another Monday Madness. I'm Nathan Baird from Cleveland.com, along with Doug Lemerice. Recapping a little bit again, Ohio State football's 41-20 victory over Tulsa and what that's going to mean for this coming week, but also kind of looking around the Big Ten, looking around college football. If you're not listening to Doug's playoff podcast each week, I highly suggest it. They are, I assume this week, they're going to talk about adding Fresno State to the possible playoff. They're crispy. I saw some Ohio State fans out there really rooting for Fresno State because it makes that Ohio, the Oregon loss yeah. look a little better transitively. But people are paying attention. There's some other teams out there that I think that are creeping onto the national radar, which is always kind of fun. But I think you guys are going to have fun with that over the course of this year because we talked about before the season that this is going to be a wide open year. And I think three games in, it really feels like that.
I definitely got at least a couple messages from our Ohio State tech subscribers about, like, you should kick Ohio State out of the playoff discussion this week, because on that show, we kick a team out every week. And last week when Ohio State lost, we kicked out Iowa State for losing to Iowa. We did not kick out Ohio State because we only kick out one team a week. But they're up for it. I mean, they're a contender to be kicked out. So, but as you said, it is very interesting that – and it was sort of what I wrote immediately after the game when we all file our stuff at the buzzer. That was my take from the game, is like, hey, guess what? Like, there's a lot of teams looking vulnerable. So let's remember that Clemson didn't look very good against Georgia Tech, and Bama almost lost to Florida, and Iowa let Kent State hang around for a half, and Notre Dame's played like toss-up games all 3 weeks against mediocre opponents, and Oklahoma had trouble with Nebraska, and Ohio State fans know what Nebraska's all about. Like, this is happening everywhere, which is not to excuse what happened with Ohio State, but it is to say it is not only them. So if they get it figured out, they've got a shot, because lots of big-time programs are having some issues right now.
I think some version of this happens every year, but if things are going well for Ohio State, maybe not to this degree, but if things are going well for Ohio State, I think we just don't pay as much attention to it. But like when Ohio State is having issues and you start looking at it and they start falling down the list a little bit, down the rankings, down the playoff predictions and all that stuff, then it starts to bring new focus to all those other people. We always do some segments, categories for the Monday Madness podcast. We're going to kind of cram those in towards the end. I think that's going to be the last segment, except for the one called Story of the Week. And this week, Ohio State going into the Akron game, I think there's actually we could do a lot of stories of the week. But I think worth still revisiting where things are going from a defensive standpoint with this program and where things are with C.J. Stroud and the quarterback situation. As you kind of rewatched that game, Doug, because you sent a text out, 614-350-3315 late last week, where you kind of came up with your own chart. Call it the Lemerice chart, the Doug something.
Little Dougie chart is a little smoother to say, so people don't have to spell Lemerice.
Little Dougie's Playhouse. What was it? What was this?
Little Dougie's Paradise.
Little Dougie's Paradise. The Little Dougie's Paradise cheat sheet scorecard for C.J. Stroud.
We probably need to address this off the top, is that someone made a Buckeye Memes Twitter account, and we're dumbfounded by it.
We should actually bring that up. The Little Dougie's Playhouse. Now, I feel like I'm partially responsible for this, because I said,
oh no, yeah,
in the podcast where this came up, the Little Dougie's Paradise, I interjected and said, hey, whoever out there is really good with Photoshop, please send me a poster for the rejected children's show, Little Dougie's Paradise. And the next thing I know, the next day, my Twitter timeline is just full of all these memes of various things that are only a Buckeye Talk listener would appreciate. So definitely go follow that account. But the Little Dougie's Paradise one was actually a little more than I bargained for. I really regretted speaking that one into existence.
It is not, if you find the Buckeye Talk memes Twitter account, Little Dougie's Paradise, that is not an actual photo of me, but it is a remarkable facsimile of what 11-year-old Little Dougie looked like when he went to the pool. So it got a little too real for me there.
But that was actually a lot of fun. I've been enjoying that the last couple of days. My wife got a kick out of it too, showing that to her. Because even though she doesn't listen to this podcast, I'm sure. But even she could like get something out of it. I think she understood without even the full Buckeye Talk context. So I hope you guys have fun with that. And thanks to whoever's doing that. And I hope you continue to have good-natured fun with it. But story of the week, I want to start off with CJ Stroud. I started rewatching some of it today while I was doing other things, AP poll and such, and the other things I have to do on a Sunday. But Doug, did you do like that a similar kind of scoring breakdown yet of what you saw from him, or is it more just?
So last week when I said to the texters, I graded every CJ Stroud play that wasn't a handoff, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 5+. 1 is like, that's a really bad play. 2 is not great. 3 is kind of like an average play, which I said, like, it's kind of like a normal incompletion or like completing a bubble screen, you know, just like that's what a quarterback does, whatever. 4 is a good play. 5 is like, man, that was a really good play. And 5+ is like, not many guys could do that. So he certainly had more 4s and 5s than he had 1s and 2s last week. But I almost wouldn't mind us doing it. I think we could come up, because it's like what everything we do, Nathan. It's like, well, what does that mean, the 5-4-3-2-1 thing? It's like, whatever it means to you. As long as it's consistent within your own parameters, you can create context. But if you and Steven and I watched every CJ Stroud game and graded it on the same scale and then combined the scales, like three judges, right, we would be able to create CJ Stroud context to say, hey, the Buckeye Talk rating for CJ Stroud against Minnesota was a 71.3, and the Buckeye Talk rating against Oregon was a 56. You know what I mean? Like, I'm almost interested in us doing that. That being said, I didn't do that. I did hit on a little thing. I didn't actually go to the Browns game today. I watched it at home. So I rewatched the Ohio State game while I was watching the Browns game, which is a really way to maximize my time. During the commercials for the Browns game, I would speed through my YouTube TV recording of the Ohio State game. This is what I did. I counted up what I thought of his completions were sort of like just easy throws, because this is where I think part of the issue is. His completions, what were like kind of like easy throws, and what does he deserve credit for? Like, man, you did something on that throw. And then his misses, what was it like, hey, what are you going to do? Everybody misses. And what was it like, that was kind of your fault? Because I think part of what at least the issue is for me, and there's enough text response, I think it is for some people, the receivers are so open sometimes. It is hard to give him much credit for, hey, you rolled to the right and Chris Olave was open by 6 yards and you threw it 12 yards to him. Because when it happens, like, do you kind of agree with that, Nathan? Like, when those plays happen, it's like, well, that looked easy. Almost, I assume 80% of Big Ten quarterbacks could do that if they had this play caller and these receivers. Because the guy, it wasn't even close. They were playing off coverage. He ran a little out, easy completion. Or some of these quick outs he throws. Justin Fields threw those too. And sometimes it can be a long throw, and I always called it free money for Justin Fields. But, you know, you've got to have a good enough arm to make those throws. But in the end, I also gave him credit for the Olave 57-yard completion that got called back by the face mask penalty, because it's not his fault. So I am considering him, and this matters a little bit too. I'm curious if you think it matters. He was actually 15 of 25 for 185. Mm-hmm. If you throw that in, he's 16 of 26 for 242.
Yeah, I don't know. I said that after. That's why I gave him a C+ in the rating after the game.
Does that change people's opinions much? I don't know. Okay, so I'm counting that as a completion. That's why I have 16 completions. Of his 16 completions, I had 10 that were easy. Bubble screens, checkdowns, some of those rollouts that were just smooth little rollouts and little pitch and catch. And I had six that I would like give CJ Stroud credit for them. Of the 10 incompletions, one, the receiver fell down. Mm-hmm. One was CJ Stroud's best play of the game when he escaped the sack and threw to Chris Olave on the run. And like Chris Olave dropped it.
Yep.
It was a little bit high, but Chris Olave should have caught that. Like, that's a drop on Chris Olave.
And not even really that high by CJ Stroud's standards.
No, like, it was like, it wasn't over his head. It was like right at his face. And then the other eight incompletions, like, I thought were kind of his fault. Whether it was a high throw, whether it was a low throw, whether it was the interception. One time he dropped the snap and then had to sort of throw it away. But it's like, well, if you didn't drop the snap, that wouldn't have happened. I thought a couple times late, like in the second half, he started holding the ball in the pocket, which is not good. So we had an incompletion where he got hit as he threw, but it's because he stood there and held the ball for too long. And if you're going to hold the ball that long in the pocket, of course you're going to get hit. So that is, I think, part of the issue here, Nathan, which is why, like, even 484 a week ago, a lot of his throws, it feels like they weren't very hard to complete. And then a lot of his misses, it feels like, man, you could have completed those. And I know that happens with other quarterbacks too, but I feel like his ratio with both of those is more stark than you often see, because the guys are so open so often. It's hard to give him credit for what he does, but it feels very easy to assign blame for what he doesn't. And if people are hearing that hit their ears and it sounds unfair coming out of my mouth, Buckeye talk, but I can't help it. And I know this isn't about me. I take that back. It is about me.
That will never be on a Buckeye Talk.
Never. I mean, that's just a lie. That's just a blatant lie. It's about CJ Stroud, but as we all try to A, evaluate him, and B, decide what that evaluation tells us about the future of Ohio State quarterbacking, that's where I am, Nathan. And it is an odd place to be, because it makes him seem at times kind of average. He's not bad. No way is he bad. He held the ball a little bit. The interception was terrible. There are times when guys are open in the middle of the field and he doesn't take it. He takes a dip. There are a couple of misses that, like, there's at least one of the misses that I blamed on him, because there was a guy wide open in the middle of the field that was the first read, and it seemed like he was looking right at him and didn't throw it. And then he threw late and high to the sideline, and Garrett tried to make the catch and he couldn't. And it was like, why didn't you take the throw that was right in front of you? That's where I am, Nathan. Do you think that you are in a similar spot? Do you think a lot of our listeners and our tech subscribers are in a similar spot?
Well, I think you make a great point about the quality of the receivers being a impediment sometimes to how we judge him. At the same time, though, what did we say for months leading up to the season was going to be a great benefit for whichever quarterback won this job? It was going to be, you're going to have a pretty veteran right offensive line, and you were going to have maybe the two best receivers in the country. Certainly the best combination of two receivers in the country. We could have a discussion at some point whether you think they're playing at the level of being the two best receivers in the country, because that Olave drop, I thought he had one actually in the Oregon game too, right before the play where he dragged his toe, which was a fantastic play. I thought Chris Olave dropped one down the sideline that would have gone for a big play. I do think that is a fair thing to point out, that you're not making excuses for CJ Stroud when you say, when you're a young quarterback, it's going to be volatile. And some of his best moments have been sabotaged a little bit.
Yeah.
The bomb to Olave, the drop by Olave, the play I was just talking about from the Oregon game, like some of his best moments have just bad luck not counted. So that has to be factored in. When you're doing a full evaluation of a quarterback's performance, you have to take out the end result sometimes and say what should have happened there. And I think the more I do that,
sure,
though, when you do that, I think as much as everything I just said is true, I think what you said is true too, that we see him just missing throws, and those seem to come at crucial moments too. Third down throws that sail wide and high, the interception in Minnesota that was wide and high, like just crucial times or crucial places. And this is, you know, hey, you know what? And this is what Ryan Day was saying too, when he said being the Ohio State quarterback is like being a shortstop of the New York Yankees. This is a scrutiny that follows. You get scrutinized in a different way than other players do.
And the other thing about being the shortstop of the New York Yankees is, if I'm going to use old baseball stats, because when I covered baseball in the late 90s, these are the stats we use. If you're the shortstop of the New York Yankees and you hit like 285 with 16 home runs, and you were like the ninth best defensive shortstop in the American League, you're not bad. You're not making the Yankees lose. They'd probably be looking to sign somebody in free agency, right? Like that's part of where we are. Maybe CJ Stroud's hitting higher than 285. I know OPS plus or whatever should be what I'm referencing, but that's part of where I am too, right? Which is what I've said now multiple times again, which may not exactly be fair, but the misses missed high. He threw a deep ball early to Chris Olave that was just like way off. Like the 3-3-5, sort of the deep coverage that they were giving that tried to take deep balls away, it wasn't exactly there, but he missed Chris Olave by like 8 yards on the one deep ball. He had just a miss on an out. He missed high over the middle. He threw the bad pick. He missed low on a rollout. He dropped the snap and threw it away. He sat in the pocket too long and allowed himself to get hit as he threw it. Like, it's just, you know, it's not 30 mistakes, but it's the continuing thing that I think it's what people are feeling. But again, he had the great play where he scrambled, he broke a sack. He really should have been sacked. And then escaped and threw a ball on the money. And Justin Fields just always felt dangerous to me, right? Justin Fields felt dangerous. And you don't have to feel dangerous with your legs, but then you probably need to be pretty dangerous with your arm. And maybe it's his shoulder, but he doesn't feel particularly dangerous with his arm to me. Like, if it's there, he'll hit it. But I don't know about him ripping something in a window. And at some point, I think you have to be one of those two things, right? Or your brain has to be a computer. Maybe his brain's a computer and he's going to be Bing, Bang, Boom guy. I don't know. Maybe that is what he is. And he's just on the way to that. It takes a little longer, but that's where I am. And I would guess that encapsulates some of what people are feeling. You can feel it. The incompletions, you can feel like he should have made those. And a lot of completions, you can feel like, well, anybody would have done that.
CJ Stroud, at times, watching him in pregame and stuff, he's windmilling that arm like he's the kid from the Cam Newton commercial a couple years ago. Maybe not quite to that extent, but definitely working something out with that. He missed the was the day that the Big Ten Network came out to practice, so we were all able to see practice, and we were told he was given a day of like a load maintenance day, like to take away from him having thrown too much, which wasn't something they did for the other quarterbacks that day. It was just CJ Stroud. Maybe they did it for them for the other days. I don't know. But like, I guess on a scale of 1 to 5, how concerned do you think Ohio State fans should be about CJ Stroud's shoulder right now?
Like, I don't think, how do I say this? I don't know that fans have to be concerned, because I don't think, it's like, what's the worst outcome of his shoulder? I think CJ Stroud and Ryan Day need to be concerned. But Ohio State fans, it's like, well, if he's really super hurt, then they're going to have to give him a rest. And then we'll get to see the other quarterbacks, which a lot of people want to see. If he's not hurt enough, if he's not injured enough, again, right, the distinction between hurt and injured. If he's not injured enough, if he's just hurt and not injured and he keeps playing, then at some point it's like, I don't know what to do, but you have to evaluate what a guy's doing on the field. And if he's not good enough, then they're going to play the backup quarterback. So, like, I don't think Ohio State fans should be worried about that. I think they should take it into account if they're walking around ripping CJ Stroud, which maybe some people think I'm doing. And it's not my intention to do that. I just think the level of play at quarterback for Ohio State could be higher. And I think if they want to win a national championship, it needs to be higher. And maybe CJ Stroud getting more experience will be what gets them there. But on some level, Nathan, I think we all deal with this with athletes. If you're on the field, like, I don't know what else to do other than evaluate your play. Yeah. And then if you can't play, then put somebody else in. And that's harder to say about a teenager, but when we're talking about the Ohio State quarterback, sort of the generic Ballot Ohio State quarterback, then it's like, well, he should be awesome.
I really don't think we're talking about C.J. Stroud any differently than we're talking about Ohio State's pass rush right now. Zach Harrison and Tyreek Smith are good football players. Nobody's disputing that they're good football players, but are they and the other guys there bringing the pass rush that Ohio State expects? Or is Ohio State getting the free safety play that to the Ohio State standard? Like, and I think we're just talking about C.J. Stroud in the same way. It is just, but it's also quarterback. It's a special position, and it needs to be talked about in a different more. It just needs to be talked about more. It's more critical.
But I do think the defensive end is a good comparison because the veteran guys there, not that CJ's a veteran, but we're talking about like older guys who were really highly rated, very talented, and maybe they're not getting quite as much pressure as we expect. So I'd like to see more JT Tumaloa. Yeah. So if JT Tumaloa is Kyle McCord or Quinn Ewers, then okay, I kind of would like to see a little more of that just to see what the deal is, because it feels like so far it hasn't been spectacular.
Tumaloa.
Did I ever say this, that the Maryland game the other night, the two announcers were saying the name differently? Did I say that in the pod the other night? One guy was saying Taulia Tongavaialoa with six syllables, and one guy was saying it with five. And it's Tongavaialoa. It's six. And the other guy, 97 times, said Tongavaloa. Tongavaloa. And it was like, It was the analyst and the play-by-play guy just back and forth saying his name constantly with a different number of syllables. So it made me feel better about whenever we mispronounce things here.
Yeah, it's not easy. Anything else about Stroud you want to interject before we talk?
No, I think a lot of it is, and I try to be very cognizant here of, like, we don't want to repeat ourselves. When we talk about something new, we try to bring something different to it. So that was my where I was after the rewatch. I tried to give it some level of a numerical evaluation. So
let's take a break here. We're going to come back after the break and talk about the defensive side of the ball here on Buckeye Talk Monday Madness. We're back on Buckeye Talk. Ohio State released its players of the game for the win over Tulsa, and Cameron Martinez, somebody who didn't even play a defensive snap in the first 2 weeks, was the defensive player of the game. A touchdown, interception return touchdown, three pass breakups, one that led to another interception by Ronnie Hickman. Actually a performance that could probably put him in the running for Big Ten defensive player of the week, I would think. I haven't gone and scrutinized all of the things out there, but that's you scored a touchdown and you led to another turnover. Like, that's probably maybe not quite enough, especially in a game where you're defense wasn't considered to have played all that well and gave up 500 yards, but still, like, a pretty impressive move forward. As you rewatched that game today, that side of the ball today, anything that jumped out at you that doesn't catch your eye in real time?
So he was also, by the way, Kim Martinez was their highest graded defensive player on PFF.
He was.
And I said before, the first couple weeks, I was not sure about the PFF grades. The PFF grades this week feel like they match my eyeball, right? That it's like, okay, well, who were the highest graded defensive players? Cameron Martinez, Craig Young, who only played 14 snaps. Tyreek Williams, yep. Marcus Williamson, a little surprising, but okay, I get it. So, like, and then the guys who didn't grade as well, is like, oh, okay. By the way, Naote Ote played one snap, according to PFF. One snap. And we talked about how the week before he was a little confused on some stuff, but the one snap he played, he made like a stop all by himself on third and one that forced Tulsa into the field goal early. They didn't block him, which is a bad decision. And sometimes it's like, well, he didn't get blocked, but he made a play off the edge on third and one that, like, saved Ohio State 4 points. He played one snap. So again, in the search for linebacker help, Nathan, Taraja Mitchell did not play. Naote Ote, one snap. Dallas Gant, one snap. It was all Simon Eichenberg, a little bit of Kayvon Pope on third down, and then they unveiled a dime package. Maybe not unveiled, but their dime package was really interesting, with Tulsa going four wide with four wide actual receivers. And they had a formation that had three defensive linemen And they had the one where it was like, they had like the, like Craig Young and Javonte Jean-Baptiste, like standing up in the middle, almost like they almost had like two defensive linemen sometimes, but they had a look where they had like the six DBs they had. I wrote it down and now I can't find it, but it was like all, okay. They had both bullets in the game. Ronnie Hickman, Craig Young were both in. Bryson Shaw was in. Lathan Ransom and Cam Martinez were both in. And then they had two corners in. So it was the deep safety, two cover safeties, two bullets, and two outside corners. So that's seven DBs. And then the linebacker in that look is Steel Chambers.
Yeah.
Steel Chambers is the dime linebacker. So then that's only three guys up front, because it's seven defensive backs, one linebacker, and three guys up front. So Steel Chambers played 17 snaps in a real role. Overall, here's what I thought. Ronnie Hickman is playing like two different positions now. Ronnie Hickman is both a deep safety and a box linebacker, which I guess is what the bullet should do. But what they really did, they stretched the definition of the bullet this week. And so they didn't put a second deep safety in the game. They just started dropping that bullet back into a deep safety position, which I guess is the same thing as putting a second deep safety in the game. But what they were doing a lot early on, in a world where in the past they'd be often man outside in a single deep safety, they had the two safeties deep, and then Ronnie Hickman would start coming downhill right at the snap. So he would kind of wind up in the box like he used to line up, but it was changing the look post-snap. It was giving the quarterback's eye is a different look, even if you kind of wound up where you were before. So some of it was cosmetic. It's like, hey, what'd you do? Well, we just started Ronnie Hickman deep and then started him downhill. But at least it gave the illusion of maybe a too deep look off the top. And then they did do some stuff. They played a lot more zone. And I do think, in conclusion, I think the number one thing that happened is they did give more looks. They did do more stuff pre-snap. They didn't just stay locked in man. All those things that seemed like a problem against Oregon, they did seem to adjust. And then they let guys get open in the zone. And they didn't let the guys get open in the zone because necessarily it was a static defense or it was too easy for the quarterback to pick apart. One is they got no push. So if you give a quarterback enough time, and you have competent pass catchers, they're going to find the soft spot in the zone. And I think they did that a lot because they didn't get any pressure again. And they did blitz a decent amount. They got a little pressure when they blitzed. They blitzed more. They had a Lathan Ransom blitz from the cover safety spot. They blitzed the linebackers multiple times. So that was one thing, no push. And the other is I don't think these guys are great at playing zone yet. So because they haven't been used to doing it. So there are linebackers dropping and some safeties floating in areas where they're covering an area. And it's like, cool, you're in an area and a guy came right in between you and you sort of didn't like figure out what to do. That they completed a lot of passes with Buckeyes sort of standing nearby. That I think if they do it more often, they'll get better at it. But they did definitely change. Again, I'm not a football coach, so recognizing it all in the moment, they did definitely adjust what they did. They gave more looks. And then the other thing is they did play more. They weren't in cover one, the man defense as much. The Denzel Burke is the kind of play that I was talking about in week one. The Denzel Burke interception that wasn't an interception. Because in that, he was up and then he dropped back right before the snap. So he's in a cover three zone look, which allows you, instead of running with the guy that you're defending, where you end up running with your back to the quarterback and you're trying to just stick your hand in front of a guy, he was able to read the play. And he broke on the ball. And he was able to break on the ball because he wasn't in man. So he did exactly, I was talking about in that game, guys were making plays and pick sixes because you give the corners a chance to read the receiver and break on the ball. And he did it perfectly. And should it have been a pick? I don't know. But it was like, oh, guess what? If you give that guy that look to play a little more often, Denzel Burke's going to be a guy who's going to make some plays like that. Because he fired. He got that. He was back off of it. He saw the ball coming and he fired while the ball was in the air and broke on the receiver. And it's like, we didn't see that a ton in the first couple games. So there were some good adjustments there. They're just not good in zone. And man, they got to get more pressure.
Yeah, we didn't talk that much specifically about the Burke play, But just in the moment, and then watching the replay in the booth last night, he looks like a third year player already instead of a third game player. He looks like he just has a savvy about him. He has a football intelligence that he is translating to the field in exactly the way that you're talking about. You could tell just by being able to see his eyes on that play, and the way that I thought he approached that was just so smart, because I remember talking to you guys in the moment. Like, I feel like a lot of young cornerbacks in that spot would get there too early. They're going to interfere. They're going to just whiff on it and go for the interception in a more reckless way. And now that guy's behind him and gone, and now you've got a problem. And instead, it was just like so perfectly timed and so and I felt like he was playing the receiver, and like the interception, whether or not that was going to happen, was almost secondary. Like, but in a textbook kind of way. Like, he wasn't like not trying to take the ball, but like it was just done in such a smooth textbook way. And it's in contrast to how seldom we're saying we see people do things like that across the rest of this defense. I mean, you're talking about the PFF grades, and for people who aren't familiar, again, and we've talked about how accurate they might be, you have to kind of look at them, I think, over a long period of time and not make too much of a single game. But I'm going to make something of a single game, because it's on a scale like 1 to 100, and the higher the score is, the better. And like, they break it up based on like overall defense, rush defense, tackling, pass rush, coverage. And Ohio State's maybe getting like one or two guys that grade above an 80 in any of those things. But most of the time, you're talking about guys that are topping out 70s. The pass rush grades were really not special, except for Tyleek Williams had a decent one, and everybody else was in. You get to a point where it goes from like blue down to yellow, and then even worse colors than that. And like the mid-60s is like this kind of puke green color, and I feel like that's appropriate, because that's like the point where like if you're too high on that list for Ohio State and that's the best color you have, then that's a problem.
Yeah, no, they just do not have guys affecting the quarterback. So I do think that is a, and of course they didn't have Zach Harrison, and JTT did play a lot of snaps. Like he's coming. He's the guy who took that opportunity. You know, they really leaned on Tyreek, but Tyreek Smith played 58 snaps among the ends. Javonte Jean-Baptiste 47, JTT 45. So like he's right there. He's by far, he was the third guy for sure. And then Jack Sawyer just still continues to be kind of down the list from that. He played 17. I do want to talk a little bit. There were some things, again, you saw some stuff late. Tulsa ran something late where they kind of had two receivers crossing down the field, and the quarterback kind of threw it early. And it felt like if he had waited another second, maybe both guys would have broken open. But part of that was, I think they got a defensive look they weren't expecting. Because like Craig Young was back there kind of in the mix with that.
When they dropped back to like three safeties, basically. Yeah.
Which again, and that's their dime look when you have two bullets on the, and then the bullets are playing like deep safety and they're doing stuff. Then I think like Craig Young had a situation where like on first down, he was back like a deep safety, and on third down, he was standing over the center like a blitzing linebacker. And it's like, okay, this is some stuff. Like that's what you're looking for. That series. So that was later in the game, but the Denzel Burke near interception series. On first down on that series, they blitzed two linebackers. And again, mostly the linebackers are Simon and Eichenberg. They blitzed both of those guys, and Cody Simon comes through and makes a tackle in the backfield for a loss of two. So now you're second and 12. So being aggressive and blitzing on first down paid off, and it gets Tulsa behind the chains. Now there's a low snap and the quarterback's kind of got to get rid of it. And he throws it away on second down. And then third down's the Denzel Burke pick. But it starts with the aggressive call on first down, where you're not just waiting for something to happen. You start them behind the chains. And then all of a sudden you get a quarterback who's got to make a throw on third down, which allows Denzel Burke to make a read and a break on a ball. And it all comes together. Because if you just sit back in man, and you never blitz, and you're not getting any four-man pressure, nobody's ever on the defensive. And that's what it felt like early, that this was not in the first two games. This was not perfect by any stretch. But at least Tulsa, at times, they counterpunched really well sometimes. But at least Ohio State tried to throw the first punch sometimes. And in a world where they did it without Zach Harrison, they did it without Taraja Mitchell, it was a new play caller for the first time. There's a lot to fix, but I do think it was improvement.
Yeah, and I think the thing that was really killing him against Oregon was when you're allowing 7.1 yards a carry, that you're not taking a team off schedule ever. Like, they are always in an advantageous position, second down, third down. They can kind of dictate what's happening on the field to you more than the opposite. And they, I think by being able to stuff the run a little bit better, regardless of what the problems that they were seeing in coverage at times, they at least got to dictate the terms a little bit of how that game flowed. And there was like that stretch of like five or six possessions in a row where they had stops and got them off the field. I also think too, though, man, I wonder how different this game could have turned out if Tulsa had had just a little bit more courage on those, especially that first drive. Man.
Phillip Montgomery is like a coach from the 50s. I'm sure he's a fine person and he motivates his players and stuff. He calls a game like he's in the 50s. Everybody's going for it on fourth down, dude. I don't know what to tell you. Everybody in the NFL is doing it. Everybody in college is doing it. Like, it's not even a discussion anymore.
There's the guy from Presbyterian right now who there. I saw somebody tweet out that he punted the other day because he punts so seldomly, but it was like fourth and 12 from his own 8 or something like that. So only a lunatic wouldn't punt there. But like, then the opposite end of that, you've still got coaches who, while trying to pull a monumental upset, are knocking on the door of a touchdown to start the game and will kick the field goal.
And there's coaches forget about the advantage, especially when the other team has a young quarterback, of making them start from the 3-yard line.
Yeah.
Like, that's, it's not like, oh, you got stopped on fourth down and now they get it at midfield. They're at the 3-yard line. And guess what? Make a couple defensive plays, make them punt, get it at midfield, and have a 50-yard touchdown drive. Like, don't take the three. You should only take a three when you have no other options. That's where we are in football right now, especially when you're an underdog. And the idea of like, well, I just want to get our guys on the board. Ah, ah. I don't know what he said after the game, but I'm assuming it was,
whatever he did, I'm sure he said it exactly in that tone. By the way, I also, to factor into this discussion, I don't know if I want to kick the ball to Emeka Egbuka right now. He's looking pretty good as a kick returner.
Mm. Yeah, right. I mean, there's a multitude of reasons. It's not like the best reason to go forward is because you might get a first down and then get a touchdown. 7 points is more than double 3 points. But there are other reasons to do it too. And that's like, they don't take that into account. Threes aren't nearly as valuable as coaches who think it's the 50s think they are. It's unbelievable to me.
But man, just imagine like going up 7-0 right there against a team that is coming off a loss and a defense that's already still on its heels and is a little bit discombobulated because, or at least just figuring things out on the run because they got a new guy calling plays. And I think that was just a monster missed opportunity right there. And Ohio State should feel a little bit fortunate. It's one thing to like play kind of the bend but don't break. But if part of that is that you're banking on the other coach to be a bit of a coward, then that's a tough strategy.
Yeah. I mean, you lose your players too. You think you're doing your players a favor by getting them three. You're not. They want to go for it. And guess what? If you make it, everybody's in it together. And if they miss it, they're going to be like, coach, we're going to get that back for you. You know, like there's just psychologically going for it and making it is so by far the best solution, right? That's the best outcome. It's 10 times as good as kicking the field goal. And going for it and not making it, I think is like only slightly worse than kicking the field goal. Yeah, it's deflating, but like at least you tried. You didn't give up.
And I know it's hard to assume that you're not going to give up so many points in a game like that against Ohio State in their place after they just put up 500 yards of offense the week, 484 passing yards on Oregon the week before. I mean, and you only had to get 1 yard to get a new set of downs. You didn't have to get in the end zone.
And the play, the third down play, as we said, you left a linebacker unblocked who tackled the guy in the backfield, which is why your third and one didn't work. So it wasn't like, just like block the linebacker next time and run the same player. Guess what? Run a little play action boot and get your quarterback on the edge. And like it, 85% of the time, it's going to work.
So that's my margin call. I'm selling cowardly coaching once and for all at its lowest price point. But we're going to get to the other categories when we come back from break here on Buckeye Talk. Back on Buckeye Talk, we are running down the Monday Madness categories. Ohio State opened as a mere 53-point favorite against Akron. The first time they've been a 50-point favorite. Did you read what I wrote about this on this post, Doug? You remember the last time they were a 50-point favorite?
Was it the Rutgers game?
It was Rutgers in 2019, and it was the Rutgers then became like the first team to score first half points or first half touchdown against them, and they only won 56-21. So they did not cover the 51 or 52, I think it was.
Was that the game where we were writing about, is this going to be the biggest spread in college football history, or was that a couple years before that with Rutgers? There was definitely a time.
I think it was that one. They were kind of at the bottom.
And Ohio State was undefeated and rolling, and it was like, this is the largest miss. Because at least that's a big – that's the thing. It's like Akron's doing their best thing.
Yeah.
They're a MAC team. That was a conference game. It was a 50-point spread.
Well, yeah, and so there's this one. By the way, it immediately got bet down to like minus 49, which is where it was the last time I checked. But the only other 50-point spread that I could find in the Odd Shark database, which is a really good tool if people just want to like look back at weird point spreads through the years, Ohio State was favored by 51 or something like that against Florida A&M in 2013. Mm. You probably remember that. And they won 76-0. Not sure why that game was played. But
well, I know why it was played, because – the Florida A&M band, I can't think of their nickname right now, is a tremendous, tremendous band.
Right. Yes, yes.
And it was, I always said it was going to be like, they scheduled the bands, and then in between the band performances, they were going to play a football game. But the Florida A&M band had a hazing scandal, and their band didn't come. Oh, so wow. It was like, I think they're called the Marching 100. They're awesome.
They are,
it
yeah.
It would have been like, it would have been a tremendous show of their band and Tibiddle, and then it was like, oh, the band's not here? They're being punished? Oh, I guess we'll just play the football game then. And it was like, yikes.
Buckeye Talk has done a terrible job so far of picking against the spread.
Oh, I was good. Buckeye Talk has done a terrible job. Buckeye Talk is also a contender.
So can't wait till Friday and see what we do with that 49-point spread or wherever it is at that point. But I was the one who picked 53-10 this past week and was woefully incorrect, and I might have just been 1 week ahead of when Ohio State opens up a can. But we'll see. That's a big number. And if Ohio State runs the ball the way they did this past week, maybe you don't score it. But although if you're getting it in 40 and 50-yard chunks, then you can still put up a lot of points.
I mean, Ohio State's definitely going to play its backups, though. I would, if you're thinking about betting this game, just give it to charity. Don't give it to the casino. Don't give it to that app. I welcome our betting app overlords when they finally come to Ohio. But for now, just give it to charity. Just pretend you bet it. Just go drop it in a collection plate or drop it at a food bank. Can we start that? Can we start the Buckeye Talk is terrible at betting food drive? Can you please take the money? I'm going to do it. I'm going to take $50 to my local food bank this week. And on behalf of my dumbness, I'm going to give it to that food bank. So on behalf of my dumbness, I challenge you to take any money you would consider betting on Ohio State this week and give it to a worthy cause of your choice. And if you would like to put in your for your taxes to write it off, just write in the little line for Doug's dumbness, $50 donation, or whatever you can give, 5, 10, anything is great. Let's turn our stupidity into something good. Buckeye Talk.
So right now we're trying to decide whether it will be a more or less a 49-point spread. Do you think it will be more or less a 75,000-person crowd?
Oh. We did not talk about that after the game then, right? After we had talked about it a lot in our preview show.
I don't believe so, no.
And predicted exactly what happened, which is nobody went. And it was...
Well, not nobody. 70-some thousand people went or whatever, but...
Relatively nobody. It is a shocking number. Shocking number for Ohio State that gets 100,000 every time. And I always... Just for context, I always reference the Troy game after the USC loss in 2008. It was the emptiest I'd seen in the stadium. This was the emptiest now. But checking the box scores, they still announced 102 in 2008 for that Troy game. To announce 75 just blows your mind. But I think it's possible it's more because it's an Ohio team and there will be some Akron people there and it might just be a fun Saturday. Now, the other thing is it's 7:30 at night. So college football is more fun during the day because it's like it's hey, it's your Saturday afternoon. Yeah. Or it's fun at night when it's like, let's go! Big game! To white out or when Ohio State does its cool stuff. Let's go! This is not that.
No.
This is like the Big Ten Network night games. No offense to the Big Ten Network. They're a lot like, I mean, it's like 7:30 on a Saturday night. That's Wheel of Fortune time. And there is a possibility that Wheel of Fortune might look more attractive than Ohio State Akron. So it's possible. I think the Ohio thing would make it more than Tulsa because it's an in-state team. I think the night game might make it, could make it less. I think maybe it would be less than 75.
I mean, more to the point, 7:30 is where you go home and then you watch more interesting games than the bloodbath you just watched at Ohio Stadium when Ohio State beat Florida A&M 76-0 or beat Akron by whatever they're going to beat them by. Like, that's what people use that time for, I think. It's what I use it for if I'm lucky enough to not have to cover a 3:30 or 7 o'clock game.
And, or God forbid you go out on a Saturday night and enjoy life outside of football in the fall, which is also allowed.
Actually, I did do that after the Oregon game. We had my wife had some friends in town, so I did go do that a little bit after the Oregon game. But yeah, for the most part, I think a lot of fans. I mean, when I go home, I mean, I come home and my Twitter timeline is just full of other reporters who are just watching other football games that night. And I assume it's what a lot of other fans do too, because people love college football. Fear factor. I think in some ways, did the Tulsa game realize we didn't do these categories last week. I don't think the fear factor of Ohio State losing would have been very high for the Tulsa game, but I think it probably realized a lot of people's fears in that they didn't feel a step forward. So no, I think that's right. Is the thing. Like Ohio State, I didn't think Ohio State needed to like dominate Tulsa. I feel like they needed, and it ends up being a 3-score game, but it was a 7-point game with Ohio State driving with 4 minutes left to play. So let's remember that as far as like how the game control factor of this game. So I feel like this is a week where Ohio State kind of has to make a statement, but at the same time, I'm saying that watch these games. There's still a lot of places where they need to like determine who the best players are. And that makes it a little bit tricky.
I mean, this is they're going to play the backups. This is their best. This is like maybe their last great chance to play backups. So, and not just a quarterback, like Marvin Harrison Jr. has to get a little run here, man. Like Julian Fleming needs to feel good about himself. You know, on defense, maybe there's not that many backups to play because
they're all playing.
They've already played so many guys. But like if Jordan Hancock wants to get a little run, like this is his time to do it. If you'd like to get Reed Carico some snaps in his first year in Columbus, this is your time to do it, right? So, you know, they do have to do that. So, I mean, the fear factor is zero, right? I mean, it's just it's a MAC team that is not going to be dangerous to them. I would tell you the only actual fear factor here in ESPN's like FPI ratings, Akron's, that's who it is, right? It's Akron.
Yeah.
Akron's 129th out of 130. The only team worse is UConn. So like, it's not even, we were saying how like Kent State hung with Iowa last week for a while, but like Kent State is like significantly higher than Akron. So that's not where we are. Let's see. How much higher are they?
Maybe they're so is like Ball State that Penn State played two weeks ago.
Kent State's 91st in these ratings, and Akron's 129th. Here, let me type in Ball in the search bar. See what happens there. Ball 105 for Ball State. So the only fear factor is if you trick yourself into thinking you're actually going to learn anything. Like if the defense looks good and you're like, that's it, problem solved, then you've got a fear factor. Or if it's like, hey, you know, whatever. CJ Stroud threw for 600 yards and looked like Justin Fields. It's like, okay, let's just make sure we don't get ahead of ourselves with whatever happens Saturday.
But after 3 weeks of like really like struggling to get a pass rush going and now you maybe get one going against Akron and you're like, eh? Right. And then everybody's gonna be like, what are you showing me? Like,
I hope we are. I mean, we have to be. Yes. But yeah. So if they have 9 sacks and you're like, Zach and Jack sack attack, baby, it's back. It's like, okay, Let's see what happens against Rutgers.
Ballot boxing. This is where I give Doug an opening to mock my AP ballot. I don't know if he even saw it today. I'm going to mock my own and say the one flub that I probably made is I didn't move Florida up after they lost Alabama, nor did I move them down. I kept them static where they were at number 13. But the more I look at it, they're probably better than some of the other one-loss teams I have ahead of them. But they also, their first two games were like Florida Atlantic and South Florida. So I don't know how much to take from that. So I don't feel too guilty about it.
Where do you have Ohio State?
11th.
I'm not sure Ohio State would play a two-point game with Bama right now, if that's one of the teams you're referencing.
Yeah, even if home, yeah.
Do you have Iowa and Penn State both ahead of Ohio State?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's a must.
I had them both ahead of Penn State already going into this week.
And who do you have number one?
Alabama.
No way is Bama one.
You'd have Georgia.
No, not even close. Miami, and that's one I've said a lot of wrong stuff on the playoff show so far. Fake good Miami, I was all over. Nick Saban, diabolical scheduling. They got rolled by Michigan State. That Alabama win over Miami in week one is worth nothing.
Yeah.
And Florida didn't even play its best quarterback on Saturday. I think if they played Anthony Richardson some, Florida might have won. And by the way, if their kicker could make an extra point, Florida might have won in overtime. That Alabama defense gave up a lot. That is not – if people – and we were getting a lot of questions on the playoff show. Should we just hand the trophy to Bama now? You got suckered, folks. You got suckered by the Hurricanes, who stink. They're going to be 3-9. So we can go back to the end of the year and say, oh, Bama beat number 14 to start the year. Bama is not as good as you think. I'm not saying Bama's bad, but it's not like Bama is a cut above anybody. Bama's just like basically everybody else this year, which is like good. They're good. They have good talent, but they also have holes. And I think the team that is the closest to not having holes is Georgia. And by the way, when you have a win over Clemson and like everything else that goes into that, and that they did it without a bunch of their skill guys, and then in week two they had to play their backup quarterback, and then they looked pretty good in week three. I don't. Bama's still number one in both polls, right? In the actual voting? Yeah, it's silly to me. I mean, that's just inertia.
They're an overwhelming number one in the AP poll. They had 59 of 62 votes.
I mean, there's zero reason for it. They beat Florida by two. Georgia, like, handled Clemson, right? Like, Clemson's the better win. What's better win, Clemson or Florida? And Clemson and Georgia look better in it. You don't think Clemson's better than Florida? I mean, it's one of those things. Okay. I mean, I do.
I have Clemson ranked ahead of Florida. I have Clemson ranked ahead of Florida. I think it's – and one's a neutral site, one's on the road. You can factor that in if you want to. But
I just think, like, there's nothing that Bama's done to me that would indicate that they're better than Georgia. And I thought that before last week, and I really think it now.
I have every week considered Georgia ahead of Alabama. I have kept Alabama there, but I certainly have no argument with someone who puts Georgia first. I think that's a very plausible argument to make. So where would you put Iowa and Penn State right now?
I might have Penn State ahead of Iowa at this point. I thought that was a very good win. If Sean Clifford is going to be serviceable, and I know he threw pick or whatever, I guess, right? I mean, that's a big home field advantage. It's not like they dominated. I think Penn State has several very, very good players. And I think when you look at Iowa, you know, the Iowa State game, they won the turnover battle 4-0. Their defense is very smothering. I don't think they're as – Tyler Goodson's really good. I think Penn State's more explosive on offense. And I think Penn State's defense has a chance to be really good. I don't know. I mean, one of the things, like, I don't necessarily do that. I haven't done it yet for the playoff show. We do rankings there. I would probably have like Penn State 4 and Iowa 6 or something like that. Cause I think I'd probably have Georgia, Bama, Oklahoma, Penn State, Oregon, Iowa would probably roughly be my ballot.
Why Oklahoma still that high?
It's a no particular reason.
Run, yeah.
I mean, no particular reason. And I would hear arguments for it.
I had him 6.
Like, because I still think Spencer Rattler's dangerous, right? But no, I hear that. I hear that. You could, people could probably talk me into Oklahoma lower.
I did Alabama, Georgia, Iowa, Penn State, Oregon, Oklahoma.
You have Iowa third in the country.
Yes.
Okay.
But I think you're right that I think Penn State has just as good of an argument, if not better. I mean, they went into Wisconsin and won. We'll find out more, a little bit more about Wisconsin this week when they play Notre Dame in Chicago. But I agree with you that I'm not as high on Notre Dame as some people have been. I have several one last teams ahead of them on my ballot. So I think you could very easily make a case that Penn State should be up there. But both of them have far, far better resumes right now than Ohio State does. If Oregon actually moved up to third in the actual poll, so they're ranked number three overall now, even though they're only up 17-7 on Stony Brook at halftime this last week, which gave me a little bit of pause. And then I had Oklahoma sixth ahead of Texas A&M and then Cincinnati eighth.
Texas A&M's good. Their backup quarterback looked much better this week than he did when he had to come in the week before. By the way, and this, we're going to talk a lot about this on the playoff show, Bama's going to lose in 2 weeks. I'm not that I'm alone in this. Matt Corral's going to slice them up, the Ole Miss quarterback, and he's going to win. He's going to become the Heisman leader when he does it. And if Bama's not careful, if they hang their heads after Ole Miss, then Texas A&M has a chance to get him too, because Texas A&M's defense is really good. They have two great backs. They have a great tight end. And if the backup quarterback is at least serviceable, they've got a chance, because they are as close as you're going to find on Bama's schedule to trying to match Bama's talent. But Matt Corral is going crazy. He's having – and it's not out of nowhere. People knew this, but, you know, I picked Sam Howell to win the Heisman. Like, he's having the Sam Howell year through 3 weeks. He's the guy. He's the NFL quarterback who is in college right now slicing people up.
The last category is who's number two. It's one that we added just for this year to pick who the second best team in the Big Ten is. And I think we've already both just answered that. You think it is Iowa with Penn State above it, and I think it's Iowa with Penn State slightly below them.
Yeah, no, I don't. We could do that. You don't do like Big Ten power rankings or anything as part of your madness, right? I mean, some people like to do that stuff. I mean, I would say I would have a hard time. I would like to hear the rationale from somebody who had Ohio State higher than third in any kind of Big Ten power rankings right now, what it is. And if the answer is, well, they have the best players, they have the most talent, that is correct. So that would have to be the rationale. But they haven't played that way.
That spread is not as big as it, and you know, and it's, you know, Steven does a breakdown every week of like comparing teams' talent to each other. But right now there's a lot of talent when you're talking about the five stars and the high ranked guys that aren't actually playing for Ohio State. So if you whittled it down to just who's actually on the field, that disparity is not as wide as it has been. If you take Quinn Ewers out of it, you take Kyle McCord out of it, you take some of the freshman defensive players out of it. Jack Sawyer, who is only playing, he played like a 17 snaps, something like that, this past game, but had been playing very, very sparingly before that. Take some of those players out, because they're not really impacting the outcome of the game, and then that star power really starts to dwindle.
Yeah. And Mekhi Buka not getting a chance to do very much right now. Paris Johnson's a great player, but you're playing him at guard right now. And like, is he changing the world at guard? It's not his fault. No, I agree with that. By the way, I don't know. Are you a little worried about – Ryan Day said the Thayer Munford injury after the game. He said it shouldn't be long-term. Say he's out a couple weeks, though. Would you be greatly concerned? Do you think they'll be fine with Matt Jones?
I think they'll be okay. It's one of those things where we don't get to watch every snap of practice, and sometimes it's tough. We talked about this so many times. You're getting caught between when they're giving you a real evaluation and when they're messaging something. But they kept talking in a positive way about Matthew Jones into preseason camp, even after we had found out that they were rearranging that offensive line. I think they like what he can be. And I think it makes more sense to have him at guard than center and have to count on him. We also don't know where exactly the situation is with Harry Miller. He was inactive again this week. We did absolutely see him at practice on Wednesday, but I didn't think he was going to play because everybody else was walking in with the lineman braces on their legs, and he did not, which I took as a sign of like, well, he's returned to practice, but is he a full participant? If there was an illness-related thing, there's an acclimatization period you have to go through in order to return to practice, and he may not have been cleared from that in order to be active to play this past weekend. So if he gets back in the mix, then maybe he's also involved at left guard if Thayer Mumford has to miss for a while. I doubt, though. I think this is what they would do, though. I think it's Jones or someone else playing left guard, and you just roll with the setup the way it's been. You keep Petit Frere at left tackle. You keep the rest of the setup the way it's been. I think this past weekend it was great. Now, you're only playing Tulsa, and they're playing only a three-man front, which is going to be more susceptible to the run sometimes, I think, that 3-3-5. But you couldn't really argue with the results you got from here. And as I said the other night, I think Ohio State's at a place where you find something that works and repeat it. You can't get too fancy with it.
Matt Jones had two previous chances to win a job on this offensive line this offseason and did not. The first was to win the interior offensive line spot. They decided, well, we're going to make DeJuan Jones the right tackle and make Thayer Mumford a guard. That was one. The second was, hey, where's Harry Miller? We need another interior guy. It could have been Matthew Jones at center.
Yeah.
It wasn't. It was Luke Whippler. So now he's getting to play because it's the third opportunity. So he was their eighth offensive lineman. No, I guess he was their seventh.
Seventh.
But
again, the first thing you're talking about too is it's not just a head-to-head competition. There's also a philosophical decision that's being made.
No, it was a head-to-head competition because we thought Matthew Jones was going to win the left guard spot, and he didn't, so they changed everybody else on the offensive line as a result. It was absolutely a head-to-head competition between DeJuan Jones and Matthew Jones to be the fifth offensive lineman. I don't think they wanted to make Thayer Mumford a guard. They were open to it, but they would have been open to letting everybody else stay in their position and just filling a hole.
I won't get dragged down into a semantic argument at this point, but I agree with the overall principle of what you're saying, which is that you are now having to rely on someone farther down the line. Now, but at Ohio State, that's not supposed to be a crisis.
No, but we can't do this. This is like the thing that I don't – we can't say that Thayer Munford's an All-American and it's so valuable that he came back changed the whole team and then be like, that's fine.
Yeah, no, you're right.
We think Thayer Munford's great and special and a leader and an NFL player, then replacing him with their seventh best offensive lineman is a drop. So I'm not saying it's disastrous. I'm not saying that.
Yes,
but it is a drop. Yes, I think when they play a good team – they might miss him.
I think that is a fair thing to ask, but I don't know when they will next play a very good team. After the Akron game, Maryland and Rutgers are up next. They're a combined 6-0 right now. Maryland is getting votes in the AP poll, but those seem like the kind of teams you should still be able to beat with Matthew Jones and then try to get – if it is even this long of an injury for Thayer Mumford, then you get a bye week after that. So you could be a month out before you play a team that like really kind of worries you if you're Ohio State.
I mean, it is crazy to say, but – with Ohio State at the moment, I would overlook Rutgers and Maryland at your own peril. Like, I'm not calling anything. But the last time people felt like this about an Ohio State team, they beat Maryland because Maryland missed a two-point conversion in the final seconds. So,
Big Ten East, Maryland's got, West, who you got?
Yeah, that's one of those things. Does this mean the Big Ten for real? We haven't talked about Michigan yet. Maryland's better than they used to be.
Oh, Rutgers I actually was
better
about
than
to...
they used to be. Penn State's better. Michigan's better. Michigan State is better. The only team, well, this is a podcast this week. The only team in the Big Ten East this year that's not better than last year's Ohio State.
And maybe Indiana.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about Indiana.
But Indiana has losses to Iowa and Cincinnati. I mean, they've lost to top 10 teams that are in the top 10 right now.
But there are so five up, two down, and Ohio State's one of the two down. Now they're coming down from making the national championship game, so they're graded on a different curve than Maryland. But
I should have introduced this earlier because I've literally got soup on the pot on the stove, and I want to go eat it, so I don't have time for another half hour about this. But I've got a piece in the Madness column for Monday morning, which is could the Big Ten East plausibly argue that it is the best division in football if Ohio State's having a down year?
That is a great philosophical argument. That is a great philosophical argument because I like the SEC West, it's like, oh, everybody thought LSU stinks. A&M's good. Ole Miss is in the West, right? Ole Miss is good. Mm-hmm. Bama's good, but not as good as last year. It's a very similar conversation, right?
Bama, like, A&M, Auburn, Ole Miss. And who am I forgetting that's also I'm blanking on who else. Arkansas looks decent. So you're getting all the way down to your sixth team.
Texas. And yep.
So your last two teams are LSU and Mississippi State. LSU is dangerous but flawed. And Mississippi State's 2-1. Like, Mississippi State is a team that, like, if you look at the computer ranking stuff, is getting some decent through three games, small sample size. So, yeah, I don't think I'd put the Big Ten East on the SEC West level. SEC West level quite yet. But it is interesting that we've talked before about how much it would help Ohio State to have the bottom of the Big Ten East rise in stature to a point, but just enough to, like, get the respect for the win without being threatened by it. But now it's happening in a year where Ohio State's sliding a little bit back down towards to maybe meet them.
But I'll tell you what, if you lose to Oregon, it's great for Ohio State that Penn State and Michigan might be top 10 teams by the time they play. I mean, this is exactly what Ohio State wants. And then if you can't beat Penn State and Michigan, then you don't deserve to be in the playoff, of course. So, like, that's obvious. So, like, this is good. This is good for Ohio State.
The other thing that was on the tip of my tongue was, if the game were being played Saturday at Ann Arbor, what would the spread be?
I wanted to bring this up because I'm sure some people saw it. It's a quote from the Northern Illinois head coach after getting steamrolled by Michigan on Saturday. He said, "They built their team to beat Ohio State." That's Thomas Hammock said that. Michigan is rushing for an average of 347 yards per game. Ohio on Saturday, Michigan scored a touchdown on its first nine drives. That is crazy. They beat Northern Illinois 63-10. That's crazy.
They did to Northern Illinois what I thought Ohio State would do to Tulsa.
Yes. I spent 7 years in the Big Ten and have a pretty good gauge of the level of competition and talent in that conference, Hammock said. And when I looked at the tape, this was a very good football team. They beat us soundly in all three phases. That was just a better team. That is a better team than us, and that's the bottom line. If they stay committed to the style that they play, they're going to win a lot of football games. So they're running the heck out of the ball. And I have not watched a ton of Michigan yet this year. They're on my rewatch list for Monday. If the line, I say it would be Ohio State -3 in Ann Arbor.
I think that'll come as a shock to the system. But we'll see how it plays out over the next 6 weeks, 8 weeks.
Again, there's definitely a psychological component for Michigan in this series, right? That they can't just go into that game. I mean, even if they are, quote, the better team, which I would not say they are right now. I would not say Michigan is better than Ohio State. Ohio State still has more good players than they do. But even if they were, there's a roadblock there that they're going to have to deal with, and they're going to have to find a way to get over the top, because they've been favored to win this game a couple times in the last couple of years, and it has not gone well for Michigan. So that has reached the point where it is psychological as well as talent-based. So, and we could be following – listen, I do want to do a podcast. So we're doing the podcast this Thursday about what it's like to cover Ohio State. We'll have a bunch of beat writers from other sites on, and that'll be a fun thing. I asked a question before the game, given some of the minor drama on the Ohio State beat this week. I asked the tech subscribers if they would be interested in a podcast about what it's like to cover Ohio State. And we can have all the writers on and how they go about it, why they cover the team the way they do. Would you be interested? Yes, very much. Got 82%. I don't know, maybe got 13%, and definitely not got 4%. So that's why we're doing it. But Nathan, I am thinking the next week for Rutgers week, there's something that Bill Simmons said on a podcast in the last month or so, that as a Red Sox fan, a great deal of his enjoyment is the Yankees losing, and that he takes almost as much enjoyment from the Yankees losing as he takes from the Red Sox winning. And even in moments when the Red Sox aren't winning, he still takes great enjoyment from the Yankees losing. I would like to delve into it with Ohio State fans, if they could put to words how much their recent enjoyment of Ohio State football, how much is it contributed to by the fact that Michigan has also struggled? That it's not like Ohio State could be doing what it's doing, and just Michigan could be losing to Ohio State every year and having one loss in the conference. And like, Ohio State makes the playoff every year and Michigan's a top 10 team every year. But that is not what it has been. Michigan's been bad. Then they got it back, but they still lose big games all the time, right? That they could acquit themselves wonderfully 11 weeks a year and just lose to the Buckeyes, but they've also had other shortcomings. So I would like to get our heads around how much Ohio State fans really enjoy that and how much they would miss it if Michigan gets good. Because I don't know if they're good, but they, Nathan, they might be. They might be.
Well, and it's all relative. The level of good that they are this year doesn't have to be as good as they would have had to have been to beat OSU in some previous years.
Right.
Same as Penn State. Same as Michigan State. Debuted at number 20 in the poll this week. People are believing in Mel Tucker after that win down at Miami. So we'll see. Get the text, 614-350-3315. Doug just laid out what's coming on the pod a little bit this week, but we'll have our usual no pod on Tuesdays. But on Tuesday morning, we will be – Tuesday noon, I should say. We'll be at the Woody talking to Ryan Day, talking to hopefully some assistant coaches, talking to hopefully some players. We got only Ryan Day last week. We'll see if they open things up again this week after a win. $3.99 a month after two-week free trial for those texts. We bring you the intel all week. And we'll be back on Wednesday with another edition of Buckeye Talk. And now I hate it when I do that, because now I can't do it.
Because you wanted to say with another edition of Buckeye Talk, and then I would scream at you, that's not how we end it! So
we'll,
now
we'll see if I can creatively edit that. But if not, for Doug Lee Maurice, I'm Nathan Baird, and that was Buckeye Talk.